Welcome to the AquariMax Audio Show with Russ and Kelly. We provide information on all kinds of aquarium-related topics.
This is episode 132, recorded September 26, 2012. Greetings, everyone. Contrary to what you might think, I'm not alone this evening. Kelly is actually not able to be here, but I have three live special guests right here in the studio, so we'll look forward to talking to them. Before we do that, though, let's talk about Michael in Arizona, his angelfish situation, some developments there, and Mick in Carnforth has some information for us, too, that relates to last week's discussion about using leaves in aquaria. I was hoping you might be able to pipe in on that, and he did, so that's a great thing. And then we have a question from someone on one of our YouTube channels that I thought most or many aquarists might find of interest, and so I'm going to talk about that also on the show, from someone who is, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing this right because of the spelling here, maybe Curious Rose, or maybe Kyrus Rose, I don't know, it's K-Y-R-U-S-R-O-S-E, so anyway, about microworms, and then we'll do the interviews. So here we go. With Michael in Arizona, he says that in reply to my question about antibiotics and what type of antibiotics he had, he said they were API antibiotics. The company that made them was API, and he's already used them all up and the packages are gone, so his information on them is limited, but they came in a blue wet nap looking package. And the cheapest he could find that he had said he really liked the fish and wanted them to live, but couldn't really justify spending hundreds of dollars on a fish that is only $3, or in this case, free, because he bred them. And I asked him if the other fish that had eaten the frozen food, if they were angelfish or not, and he said they weren't. They were guppies, mollies, gouramis, danios, Colombian cat sharks, and others that did eat, yet did not have any ill effects. The fish are spread out through a couple of tanks and are not all together. I also asked him about the swelling in the bellies, and he said their bellies were swollen quite large, the largest I have ever seen in any fish. The angels are about a full silver dollar size, at about a year or a year and a half old, not including the fins, and it looked as if they had eaten a mini marshmallow or two whole kernels of corn. So, yeah, pretty swollen for angelfish of that size. As of today, he continues, the swelling has gone away, and their bums have cleared up. I have placed them back in their 40-gallon tank, without any meds, and I keep the water clean with at least 25% water change every other day and 250-gallon capacity filters, thinking the small quarantine tank was making them clamp their fins. Yeah, that makes sense. As of today, they seem to eat and act normal. Fins still clamp when they stop moving, and now it looks as if they're shedding. The only way to describe this is shedding. Looks just like a reptile shedding its skin. Everything is the same in the 40-gallon as in the quarantine tank water-wise. The 40-gallon is a display tank, and it is planted. And I do dose the tank with Seachem. So, Seachem fertilizer products. I have been doing that for about 2 years. I have had this tank, and the whole time the angels have been in there. They won't hold still long enough for a pick, but I'll figure something out, because I did ask him if it was possible to get one. And then an update, a more recent update. He said, as of today, the slightly larger angels has made a full recovery, so the larger one, and looks better than he has ever looked. The other still has this sheddy-looking thing and clamped fins, but it is slowly clearing up. So, looks like one is already doing fine and the other's on the mend. Good news, and we're glad to hear it. I am still at a loss, he says, as to where this problem came from, seeing that the angels are the only ones that were affected. Forgot to mention that there are neon tetras in the same tank as the angels when they got sick. With neons being easy to get sick or die, I'm thinking it's an angelfish-only disease. Yeah, and neons certainly aren't the hardiest fish you could ever encounter. So, yeah, that's interesting. It may be a very specific one. He also says he believes the antibiotics and the salty warm water is what helped them. And thanks us for our help. And one thing I've been thinking about, Michael, I wish I could give you more information, and I hope that your angels do continue to recover completely. But one thing, I was looking up angelfish plague, and the shedding sounds very familiar in terms of angelfish plague, and the bloating can sometimes be an issue. I wonder if you noticed any red lines around the mouth or streaks around the mouth or coming off the fins into the body. That seems to be something that occurs with angelfish plague too. So some of the symptom set seems to be the same. Not all of it, but if you were to do a search, maybe you already have, on angelfish plague and see what comes up, that could be helpful. I was looking it up on webmedia.com to see what I could find about that. But still, you know, it's hard to conclude what might be the case, but at least it's going away. So thanks for all your questions and best wishes for those fish. Okay, next up is Mick in Carnforth, UK. He says, "Hi guys, good discussion on using leaf litter last week. I collect and dry both English oak, Quercus robur, and beech, Fagus sylvatica, to use in my aquariums. I find that the almond leaves do a good job, but are expensive and tend to rot down much quicker. I collect fallen leaves in autumn from areas away from traffic and other potential sources of pollution. I lay them out on a large tray in my fish room until completely dried out, and then store them in plastic bags. This way they can last for years, and I just take out what I need. I tend to put them in a large plastic jug, pour over warm water, and then allow them to cool. I strain off the soup, and the leaves then sink directly to the bottom of the tank when added. They're a good source of natural infusoria for a wide range of fry, and also give a great naturalistic look to the tank. I dare say that surface area could apply here, but that would just be pandering to Kelly's desire to burst into song." Well, it's a good thing she's not here, or a bad thing, depending on how you look at it. "If you're wanting to make a natural black water extract, use 2 to 3 handfuls of leaves, rinse in cold water to remove any dirt, then pour over a couple of pints of boiling water and stew like tea for an hour or so. Allow it to cool, and then strain off the liquid and add to your tank as required. You can then store this in a cool place, such as the fridge, in an old drink bottle." So thank you, Mick, for sharing your recipes for black water extract and for taking care of the leaves and using them in aquaria. I think that will help a lot of aquarists who are thinking about doing this. And Mick continues. He says, "Today was my fish club's annual convention day. We had great speakers from Norway, Scotland, Uruguay, and from Germany. Hans-George Evers, editor-in-chief of the Amazonas magazine. This was his second visit to our convention in the last 3 years. A superb day, very educational and fun talks, a superb 2-course lunch, a raffle, and generally a good reason, if ever there was one, for being involved in a fish club." Sounds like a good time was had by all. I wish I could have been there. "We also now have tickets," he says, "for this year's Aquatics Live event in London this coming November. Very excited about it and looking forward to seeing Heiko Blair." And I'm not sure I pronounced that correctly, but I do know this man by reputation. He's a famous aquarist who spent a lot of his life, who has spent a lot of his life, I should say, discovering fish. He's discovered tons of aquarium fish and collected tons of aquarium fish, many different species. He's famous for his work with discus, but he's, you know, equally conversant with lots of the loricarid catfish and many other species. He's done a lot of helped popularize many of the rainbow fish that are in the hobby these days. He's an amazing aquarist, so that will be cool. And once again, I wish I could be there too. Aquatics Live, that would be fun. So Mick and any other aquarists in the area, please let us know how it goes. We'd love to hear more about it. And thanks, Mick. All right. I think we'll have our break just a little bit early, and then we'll go to our interview segment of the show.
Hello, this is Ken Jones of the Prince of Ponds and Pet Tech Podcasts, and you're listening to one of my favorites, the Aquarimax Show.
Now there are more ways than ever to be a part of Aquarimax. In addition to downloading the podcast on iTunes, you can follow us on Twitter, like our Facebook page, subscribe to our YouTube channel, or call us anytime and leave a phone message at 801-477-0629, or just email us at info@aquarimax.com. And now, back to the Aquarimax Audio Show, the podcast with Icy Nell.
Okay, as we once promised, we're going to have some special guests on Aquarimax today. So here is the first of our interviewees. Welcome, Gwen.
Hi, everybody.
So, you have decided to do your science project on bettas, and you already gathered some information, didn't you?
Yes.
What did you gather your information about?
Bubble nests.
So tell us a little bit about what you observed regarding bubble nests.
The boy gets a bunch of bubbles, air bubbles, from around the tank. Then he puts them all in a big place together, almost together. And the girl lays its eggs in it. And after a couple days, they hatch, but they can't go far from the bubble nest. And so they only swim around the bubble nest. And when they are a little older, the male goes out and they can swim out of the bubble nest.
Hey, those are some good observations.
And
yes.
This is a funny thing.
Okay.
Once when the bubble nest, it was getting destroyed because the fish who took care of it got taken out. And I saw a baby betta look at it and have a weird expression on its face because it had saw the bubble nest being popped.
Oh, well, that's an interesting observation too. Now, I remember you mentioned something that you noticed that the female did. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah. The female tried to eat the eggs, but a surprising thing was the boy was very, very, very nice. And so he let her, and so she ate some of the eggs. But then we immediately took her out.
Indeed. Okay, well, that sounds like you had some great observations about bubble nest building in Betta Splendens. Do you have any other observations you'd like to share about bubble nests?
I do have something.
Okay.
Bettas like to build their bubble nests under something.
Mm-hmm.
And it would be, and they would build their bubble nests easier if they had a little square of plastic wrap up for a starter to make it look like they have to keep on building.
Oh, when we put the bubble wrap under there?
Yeah.
Yeah, bubble wrap.
And then we tried putting the styrofoam cup there, and he made a bubble nest.
Yep, so we tried bubble wrap under a styrofoam cup. Very good observations. Well, thank you for joining us today, Gwen. And what grade are you in?
First
grade, yeah. Okay, well, I think those are some really great explorational observations for someone in the first grade to do, and I hope your science project goes really well. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Okay, our second interviewee for the day is here. Welcome to Laurelyn. Thank you for joining us.
Hi.
Now, Laurelyn, you're doing an experiment relating to bettas as well, right?
Yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about your basic research question?
I am looking at how feeding the bettas different kinds of food affects their growth.
I think that's an excellent topic. Now, which types of food are you thinking about using in your experiment?
One group, just pellets. One group, pellets and daphnia, and one group, pellets and peas.
That sounds pretty good. Now, do you have any hypotheses about what's going to happen with those three food groups?
I think the pellets and daphnia.
What do you think about the pellets and daphnia?
They're going to change the most gross thing.
So do you think it will have a positive effect on the growth or a negative effect on the growth?
Positive.
And why is that?
I don't know.
Just a hunch?
Yeah, just a hunch.
Okay. Well, we'll be interested in having you back again on the show after you've done your experiment, and you can let us know how it went.
Okay.
Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you. I mean, you're welcome.
Okay, let's welcome our third and final guest for the evening, Xander. So, Xander, tell us about your experiment with betas. What are you planning on doing?
I'm studying flaring.
Flaring. So what are your research questions exactly?
How close does it take for them to get flaring?
So how close do the betas have to be to each other before they flare?
Yeah.
Okay. And how do you propose to test that?
I'll put one beta in a jar and another beta in a jar and put them a foot from each other and see if they flare. And if they don't, I'll move them closer. And if they don't flare then, I'll move them closer and I stop when they start flaring.
Okay, and that sounds like a great way to test your hypothesis and explore that research question a bit. Now, what's your hypothesis? How close do you think they have to be before they'll start flaring?
About 4 inches.
Oh, okay. Well, that'll be interesting to see. Now, how many betas are you going to do this test with?
I don't know yet.
Okay, so you still need to figure that out. Are you going to do both males and females, or just males, or what?
Just males.
Just males, okay. Well, it sounds like a great experiment. So, when you're done, will you come back onto the show and let us know how it went and what you found out?
Okay.
Okay, that would be great. Thanks for joining us today.
You're welcome.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, that is the last of our interviewees. We have another one coming soon. Our son Isaac is at Boy Scouts and will not be able to record tonight with us, but he will do so very soon, and so probably next week we'll have him on the show. I would like to give you just a little bit of an update on what's happening with our bettas right now. This week I recorded another video of them. They're really coloring up nicely, and so I'll put that up so you can check that out. So please see that on the show page or on our YouTube channel, and I'll probably put it on the Facebook page as well. I don't know whether I will continue to do approximately weekly updates in video form or not, because the bettas have reached a point at which basically, they're now just going to grow larger, and the males are color up more, and I assume the females will some as well. And the finnage will grow, and I will probably do updates still, but maybe not quite as frequent, because they're a little less likely to change quite as much. I mean, they will be changing, but perhaps not as dramatically from week to week. So, anyway, it'll be fun to see that, hopefully. And a couple of things. I've started to wean them onto pellets. I've continued to give them live food, of course, but the Addison's Beta Food, I've been crushing that up and giving that to them. It was very easy. I've heard that some people have had difficulty weaning them onto solid, non-live food, but they're eating it just fine. I would usually give it to them right before I fed them anything else, so they ate it when they were hungry, and it seems to work great. So I give them some of that before each feeding of Walter Worms or Brine Shrimp. And I'm also giving them a few Daphnia, and now they're big enough to handle some of the smaller Daphnia. So it's fun to watch them mature and so on. We're jarring more of them. I brought one into work, put it in a divided tank, actually, that I have at work there, along with the father, separated from the father, of course. And it's fun to see the family resemblance there. And he's growing very quickly. He's a big boy, one of the biggest fish in the spawn. And let's see what else. Other than that, we've been jarring them. Yeah, that's about it for the bettas. One more thing I wanted to point out. Michael in Arizona, what he was saying about his angelfish made me think about this experience. The mother of the fish, I brought it into work, and I had it in a tank, 3-gallon tank, heated and filtered and cycled, of course. At work in a room with several others. There were, I think, 4 other bettas in that room. And one day, I looked in to check on the female and doing some training. And I began to do some training with her. I had for several days, and the training was going well. But then what happened? Well, she suddenly went off her food. And I was really worried. Of course, it's a bad sign when a fish that is generally so happy about food goes off its food. I was quite worried about it. So I immediately did a battery of tests. I tested ammonia, I tested nitrite, I tested nitrate, I tested pH. I think that's all I tested. Everything came out great. There was no ammonia, no nitrite. Nitrates were under 20 parts per million. In fact, I think they were around 10, so that's not bad. The pH was what I would expect, which is really pretty high, but since the tap water around here is high, the fish was used to it. Wasn't an issue. And all the other fish in the room were on the same water changing regimen and everything, and they were doing fine. So I began to observe her and noticed that she was under what appeared to be pretty high respiratory stress. Comfortable at all in her breathing. It was very labored. You could see her gill covers were moving a lot more than they usually do with normal breathing. So she just did not look comfortable. She was a little bit swollen in the belly region and just did not look happy and would not eat. So I was really worried. I immediately changed some water, and I increased the water changing regimen for a little while there to try to change a lot of water, and just observed her. Didn't attempt to feed her for a couple of days. Wasn't sure what to do because I couldn't figure out what was going on, but I was quite worried. No signs of fin damage or fungus, skin lesions, anything like that. Not looking pine coney, like a dropsy sort of problem. But her swelling began to go down. Her respiratory stress decreased over time and over a few days. And suddenly she was back to normal. It was pretty bizarre. I'd never had quite that symptom set with such a speedy onset and speedy recovery and complete recovery. Now she's doing fine. She's back on her training and is doing perfectly fine. I just was very surprised by that. And none of the other fish had any issues. All the fish continue to be pretty healthy. But I'm just happy that she overcame that, and even though I was puzzled by whatever it was. I think the quick action of the water changes may have helped. She, like I said, the water parameters were good, but there may have been, who knows, the tank's not that far away from a window. Could have been a contaminant, although then if that had been the case, then the other fish probably would have been affected as well. So who knows? Sometimes we don't know, but in this case, all's well that ends well. And on that note, ladies and gentlemen, may the fish be with you.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Aquarimax Audio Show. For additional episodes, please visit aquarimax.com. For comments and or questions that may be featured on an upcoming podcast, leave a message at 801-477-0629 or email us at info@aquarimax.com.